What is going on, internet, and welcome to episode one of the Grumpy Gits podcast, a name I did not choose, yet I'm under duress going along with. I'm not grumpy, you're grumpy. Anyway, on this podcast, it's four guys talking about the world with disability in a way that is on the nose, accessible, and informative, whilst having a little bit of fun along the way. I am Adam Pearson. Some of you may recognise me from the TV. I've got one of those faces. Now that I have your attention, let me introduce you to the three other Grumpy Gits, again, not my name, that I'm doing this show alongside with. How you doing, Simon?
Hello, mate. How you doing? You're right.
All good, sir. All good. So, Simon, who are you and why should we care?
You shouldn't care whatsoever. My name's Simon Sansom. I'm a disabled journalist and I run Ability Access, which is the most read disability page in the world.
Fantastic. And we're also joined by a man who other disability campaigners have described as not the worst. How's it going, Chris?
I'm very well, mate. Yourself?
Yeah, you know, lockdown's going all right. Played a lot of computer games since March 23rd last year. Like an obscene amount of computer games. Also, put on 2 stone and lost it again. Because cake.
It's been a tough one, but a little bit about myself. I'm a SEND parent, an autism advocate. I've got an 8-year-old son who is autistic, and I spend my time playing computer games as well, as you well know.
Fantastic. And last, but certainly by no means least, Duncan, what's crack-a-lacking, my friend?
Mate, I think definitely least. I think in the company that I'm in, I would certainly come in last. I am a SEND parent as well, so I have a daughter who is autistic with PDA, which is pathological demand avoidance. I run a large group on Facebook. We've got 30,000 members almost, which I think makes it about the fourth largest autism-related group on Facebook, which is pretty cool. And I run a channel on YouTube talking about parenting autism and parenting PDA. So that's basically who I am and why I'm here.
Well, it's a pleasure to be sitting down with the three of you, amazing peers of mine. But before we get into the slightly heavier end of the disability discussion for this episode, are we all familiar with the saying that there's no such thing as a stupid question?
Very much so.
Yeah.
Very.
That saying is wrong. Chris, what are some stupid questions we can talk about this week?
This week, the stupid questions I've got is, what song do you feel most compelled to sing, even though you don't know the words?
Neil Diamond, Sweet Caroline. Other than the ba ba ba,
everyone knows that one line.
Confident on anything else. Sweet, the words sweet and Caroline are in there somewhere, and ba ba ba. But apart from those, it's all guesswork.
Good times never feel so good, is it? I only know Sweet Caroline and that's it.
Are you asking me or telling me? Like, help
no,
me out
no,
here, bro.
No, I'd have to do a Google search. I haven't got a clue.
I think what mine would be, which comes up every year, Auld Lang Syne.
Oh, that's a good one.
Nobody knows the words to it. You sit there, you know, doing the hands crossing thingy, all in circles, and nobody has a clue what anyone else is saying. They could be singing Bryan Adams for all they care.
It's so true. And it's the entire world experiences it on the same day. Yeah. The confusion
and
spreads.
Nobody ever goes and downloads Auld Lang Syne on New Year's to learn it. No Every one. Christmas, someone will download Wham or Mariah Carey or E17, but nobody downloads Auld Lang Syne and learns the words. But you know Mistletoe and Wine off by heart, don't you?
Nope. I tell you what I think is the funniest version of this little thing. Queen's We Will Rock You, because no one knows the verses. And you see it live, everyone's like, "Buddy, you're a young man, someday, we will." That's all anyone knows, is that what is the chorus. No one knows the lyrics.
I blame the TV show Gladiators for that. When I was a child, I was at Great Ormond Street Hospital, and they had karaoke for the kids in the lobby. And these two kids literally asked the man if they could sing the song from Gladiators. And that's all they knew. And then the rest of it were just the words lighting up. And two children, who are adults now, if you're listening, hi, just looking very confused. There were other words to the songs from Gladiators.
Second stupid question is, has there ever been a situation in your life where you wish you could have thrown a smoke bomb and disappeared?
Yeah, just a few months ago.
Oh, okay. Is that the end of the answer? Is that all we're getting?
No, I was coming out of my house and there was a neighbour who I don't really know that well. He was walked past me and he just said, good morning. I went, good morning back. And he came to pat me on the head in my wheelchair. Yeah.
What, like some kind of flipping service animal?
Yes, very much so. He just came up to me and go, nice to see you out and about.
Oh,
on top
wow.
of my head. And he's walking his dog, which is about that big, yeah? And he's walking his dog, and I'm like, don't touch me. How do you reply to that, besides from get your dirty mitts off me, you know, you strange neighbour? People should know how to speak to a person in a wheelchair, and clearly he was isolated. He's got a dog, you know. What else is there to say about him? I have got no idea who he is. He was just being polite, but then he decided to pat me on the head.
That takes it from being at least a polite exchange to utterly patronising, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, very much so, yes. So
a bit louder and slower as well. I mean, oh, it's nice to see you out.
Yeah. I mean, he made me feel like a guide dog.
I've had that done, and I always really turn up the awkward when people do the slow talking to me. People know not to do it now because I've caused that many scenes in public where people seem to have gotten the message. But people just like, oh, and how are you, buddy? And I look them dead in the eyes and just go, I need to get laid. And then just let the awkwardness hang for a good 10 seconds.
That's gold.
What's mine? When would I have needed a smoke bomb? I think one of the lower moments of the Adam Pearson childhood roller coaster. I once, and editing's a thing, so we'll see if this makes it in. I once shat myself at parents' evening.
What, was this last week or, you know, on Zoom?
This was year five parents' evening. I was acutely aware that I hadn't behaved myself that year. And I'd already faked having a headache that day to keep at least one of my parents home, but they weren't buying it. And there comes a moment when all your abilities to make smart decisions go out the window and you just hit a panic button and think, how can I get out of this? And the first thing that comes into your head, you just do it.
Oh, yeah.
That's revolting. Well, that's far too much. Can you imagine the headline in some newspaper? Adam Pearson, film star, shits himself in school. That's what the headline's going to read.
Well, and also, I was already quite nervous because I knew it wasn't going to go well. And so there may have been a little bit of kind of things out of my hands about the whole thing.
Oh,
but yeah, year five parents evening with Miss Smith, now Miss Shepherd. Oh, she might have gotten married again. I don't know. I've not spoken to her since that fateful day. that happened. Which is why you should always be good at school, so you don't wind up crapping your pants at parents' evening.
Did you admit to it, or did they smell it and figure it out?
My dad came looking for me, found me in the toilet crying.
Oh, okay.
At which point, I thought, it's worked. We're going home. Amazing.
That's a masterstroke of manipulation. I love it.
Turning Chris's question on its head, the best reply I've had to a question like that is how to cause a smoke bomb in a public space. And my best one was told me by a friend of mine called Rosa Jones, who is a comedian, where she couldn't get a seat on the bus, so she just leant on the wall and just dribbled a little. She's disabled. And they just got up and made the person sitting down there in the accessible chair a bit really uncomfortable, so they had to move.
I can see Rosie doing that as well.
I've got to say, my worst moment that I wish I'd had a smoke bomb was, again, primary school age, probably around the same age. I used to get bullied quite a bit, and I explained to my dad, look, I don't know what to do. Every time I get off the bus, it's just like everyone's jeering at me. And my dad said, he just said, look, I give you permission to swear. When you get off the bus, if they're having a go at you, you turn around, you won't get in trouble, and you tell them to F off. And I went to school the next day with this kind of beaming, you know, that kind of your authority of able to do this. And I was almost willing them to jeer me getting off the bus. And I got off the bus and it was, whoa, Casper. I turned around, it was like, F off! And there was a stunned sort of everyone, because parents were around picking up kids, and everyone was like, whoa. And full of pride, and I turned around and walked straight into a tree. Literally undid every ounce of anything I built up for myself. Seconds, and if I'd had a smoke bomb and could disappear at that moment, it would have been just ultimate ending to it, really.
The highs of victory followed by the crushing, crushing lows of abject humiliation.
It's like reaching the top of the mountain and tripping over, you know? It was,
Third stupid question. What's quickly becoming obsolete?
The BBC.
Jesus. Yeah, no. I completely agree. Myself and my agent had a conversation with their entertainment commissioner around their lack of representation. And this commissioner came in, sit down, and just says to us, did you know 1 in 5 people in the UK are disabled? And we were like, yeah, we've been telling you that for quite a while now. It'd be nice if you put them on the fucking telly every now and again.
With the BBC, for me, it's sleeping itself into oblivion. They can't compete with Netflix, Amazon. But the thing is they have a back catalogue of some fantastic shows. And they've sold it really cheaply to UK TV, BritBox. And people don't want to pay £11-12 a month for the BBC because nobody watches it anymore. Where it used to get 20 million views on a Saturday night, ITV have taken over that now. The only shows that are on the BBC, especially during lockdown, are antique shows or house shows. Or the news. Now, for me, as a journalist, the news department at the BBC is world class. And I think it is essential to the UK service. Absolutely. But the rest of the BBC, you know, is just falling asleep at the wheel. What's going on?
I do love Would I Lie to You? Shows like that. Like that's a classic. Have I Got News for You and all those shows. There are really good shows on there, but they're getting belled, I agree, with antique shows. And there was one I saw the other day, something about celebrities on a farm. Maybe that wasn't the BBC, but like, really, what are we watching these days? Is it really that? Has it got that desperate for new material?
The only thing I'd say about What I Lie to You, and yes, I enjoy it, it's been going for a bit too long, and it's the same format as it was 20 years ago. It's the same as The Question of Sport. That's, you know, they used to be able to get world-class celebrities on there, world-class Formula One drivers, world-class footballers who you want to tune in. Now, they're all bronze medal gold Olympians, which I'm sorry. I mean, I'm not saying that's an underachievement by any means whatsoever, but nobody knows who you are unless you've won a gold. And it's just, it's that kind of situation. They can't get the talent anymore because it's more popular doing a YouTube video than it is to appear on The Question of Sport.
And again, representation. How many physically disabled people do you think have been on Have I Got News for You since it started?
It's been going for 30 years now, isn't it?
Yeah.
I would say 6.
I can only think of 2.
I'm going to go 5.
One physically disabled person has been on there.
I'm sure there's 2 because there was the, I don't know her name, to my shame, is that I think the lady who, she's in Silent Witness, and I'm sure she's been on it.
Oh, Liz Carr.
And I know Alex Brooke has been on it.
Has Alex Brooker been on Have I Got News for You?
Yeah, I definitely saw an episode with Alex Brooker on it. But yeah, the fact is, 30 years and we can think of...
Yeah, yeah. The fact we can only think of a few.
It has provided Animal Planet, though, and David Attenborough, which is the most phenomenal. Hasn't been replicated the world over. And obviously, David Attenborough, anything he touches is just gold. Without the BBC, we wouldn't have had that. The MASH report as well, which I kind of like. I don't think it's holding its own, but it has got a few hidden gems.
Oh, it has. It has some fantastic TV shows. And, you know, when they pull the budget out, when you get things like Blue Planet and shows like that, they are a world-class service. But they can only do it with 1 or 2 shows. They can't do it continuously, and that's their problem.
Yeah.
Is they are throwing out stuff which is repeatable, which is predictable, and has worked the same format for 25 years, and it's really boring.
Did you know that the Blue Planet was one of the last things to get nominated for the now defunct, and this sort of proves your point a bit, Simon, Innovation Award at the National TV Awards? And if memory serves me correctly, it lost to Banzai.
That's tragic.
So we've had Simon's answer. Still need Adam and Duncan's.
The PlayStation 4. That's my answer.
That's a very apt answer as well.
I'm very much part of our fast food, fast fashion culture. Whatever the opposite to Extinction Rebellion is, it's this guy. No, technology is always becoming obsolete. We just supersede things really quickly. We innovate really quickly. The drive for progress in the tech space has always existed. And part of me loves it because I'm a techie, I'm a nerd, I'm a real science guy. But then there's a little part of me that when you spend $1,000 on a new phone and then 6 months later a new one comes out, you do roll your eyes a little bit and just think, oh, really?
Yeah, you know they do that on purpose.
Oh, completely, completely. I know it's like a marketing thing and what have you. But yeah, we're not all made of money, Simon.
Duncan, what's your answer?
With the internet at the moment, I think intelligent conversations on its way out. It really depresses me when I think about it. But you see so much on Twitter and Facebook, and people go for the bite rather than actually getting into an involved conversation. Having a sage, well thought out, educated, reasonable conversation is fast becoming a thing in the past, and I'm mourning it.
I think it's swinging back in the opposite direction, though, because of this pandemic and the lockdown. Because you think how big Zoom's made it now, yeah, and how much they talked before, whether it was by some sort of group chat or whatever. Now they're jumping on to platforms such as Zoom to actually speak. I know it's technology, but they're still speaking face-to-face. So I think it might be swinging back towards that direction again.
It would. I think we've lost the ability to communicate in more than 280 characters, and no one reads context anymore. They just read kind of headings and subheadings and jump on that. And when you jump on things and you don't know the context or what's come before it or understand the whole arena that a conversation is happening in, you just end up making really shotgun statements. Or you jump on a bandwagon that doesn't need jumping on. And no, I completely agree that long-form dialogue has fallen out of fashion, but is hopefully coming back in.
I just want to see it enter shock. Shock rock's had its day as a music style. Shock tweets and everything like that should have had their day as something as well. I think that we need to get past the saying something for the thrill of seeing people react and get on to actually having some value.
Moving on from stupid questions to another question. It might seem stupid, but trust me, it's going somewhere. Has anyone seen any good films lately?
I've got kids. All I ever get to watch are bits and pieces of YouTube clips and occasionally segments of a film before they're bored and move on to the next thing. I can't remember the last time I actually got to sit and watch an entire movie.
Oh, that's all I do. I've got no kids. I've got my niece living with me while we're in lockdown. However, you know, she's 16. She's in the bedroom all the time watching Netflix, and that's what I do. I mean, I've binge watched The West Wing about 3 times in lockdown.
I've heard that's worked you well in the past.
I must admit, I love films. I used to have a film radio show years and years ago, and I used to watch, you know, count down the top 10. I used to do reviews on films, and I used to go to the press showings, which was awesome. And today, there are no films that have been come out which I wanted to watch in lockdown. The only one I was vaguely interested in, because I'm a big DC fan, as well as Marvel, is Wonder Woman. But they wanted $15.99. And I was like, hold on, that's how much me and my wife paid to go to the cinema. Why would we pay $15.99 to sit at home, watching it at home on our sofa? We want the experience of going to the cinema.
It's because they're recouping the cost, isn't it? All these things are coming out and people can't go to the cinema because of COVID.
I watched it. I rented it. I'm glad you didn't go too deep with the insults there. I just...
disappointed it wasn't the Wonder Woman you thought it was, Chris.
It wasn't particularly... I wasn't impressed. It's certainly not as good as the first one, but the best... Well, I say the best. The last good movie I watched was Dread, the new one. And I was pleasantly surprised by that.
Yeah.
Well, the last movie I watched, for better or for worse, and this will be the main thrust of the next 10 minutes, was Sears' directorial debut, music.
Yeah.
Hollywood has long had issues with the way it's handled disability, both on screen and off screen, and in terms of casting. There have only been two actors that have won Oscars for portraying disabled characters who were actually disabled. The most recent one of those was in 1987, Marlene Matlin in Children of a Lesser God. Why do we think, before we delve into the actual problems with CSL, why do we think disability is very much not involved in the wider diversity conversation?
Laziness would be one, and ignorance would be the other for me.
I think that's it. I think it is laziness and ignorance. It's not being informed. They base their decisions on stigmas, and they think that it's going to be too difficult to cast someone, and they shy away from it.
It's like there's an unwritten rule, isn't there, of don't work with children or animals, and I think they include wheelchairs in that. It's just, it's too hard. Oh, suddenly we've got to get disability access, and you've got, oh, it's not going to be that easy. So it's just easier to find someone who can climb up the stairs first. And it's, like you say, laziness, but it's complete arrogance to it as well.
It's interesting you make the point about wheelchairs. One of my good friends, Dan Edge, who's an actor who's also a wheelchair user, when it comes to that excuse, says if you can get 10 tons of camera gear up a hill, you can get a wheelchair up a hill. So we can knock that right on the head. But
that's a great point.
That's such a good point.
What's really focusing on this Sears film, for those who don't know, it's Sears' directorial debut. Kate Hudson, Leslie Odom Jr. and Maddie Ziegler. And Maddie Ziegler's character, whose actual name is Music, which is the least atrocious thing about this film, is that someone just thought, oh, we'll call her Music. She plays a character who is on the autism spectrum, who is non-verbal. And the whole film revolves around her escaping into this... Well, it doesn't, I suppose. She escapes into this fantasy world of bright colours, dance routines, strobe lighting, whilst also being used as a prop to further a narrative between Zoo, Kate Hudson's character, and Leslie Odom Jr.'s character about how they sort of deal with their issues through taking care of her. And the whole thing is just so badly written and badly informed. Even by Rain Man 1988 standards, this would have been bad.
I haven't seen the film yet. I'm going to watch it out, because I want to see how bad it is. I can imagine how bad it is. My niece has seen it, and she was the opinion she really quite liked it. And I went, that's fine, that's fair enough. And then I explained to her it was about the autism spectrum. Then we looked at IMDb together, and there's no in between. People either give it a 10 star or a 1 star. There is no 5, 6, 7 stars in between. Once my niece realized that they didn't have anyone who was disabled on set, they didn't have anyone with autism on set, they didn't consult anyone, she went, well, that's really bad. Why not? They're doing this big promotion about autism, and they're not getting anyone who has autism involved. Why are they taking that job away from someone who has autism? And that was my niece's response.
Well, there were quotes from Sia saying that she tried working with a girl who was on the spectrum, and the girl in question found it stressful and uncomfortable, so they got rid of her. But then in another interview, she also said that Maddie found it stressful and uncomfortable as well, and they didn't fire Maddie. I'm of the opinion that this actress they tried on the spectrum doesn't actually exist. And I think Maddie was on board from the word go.
I think what's worse is that Maddie herself questioned it and said, I feel like I'm making fun of autistic people in this. When it was being made, it was actually a conversation she had with Sia, and Sia was, oh, don't worry about it, it's okay. Well, you'll see at the end, it's all going to come out, you know, and we'll see what we're doing. I found it hugely offensive in that. And I think, I haven't got to see the film yet, and I will see it. I want to make an educated decision. I want to go in with the attitude of I want to try and find something worthwhile about it as well. I'd love to be able to talk about something positive in there. But I think the way the whole thing's been handled, I think Sia's responses have been shocking. I think when you've got Autism Speaks going, not us, there's alarm bells there.
They're in the credits, and now they're going, not us. Yeah, that's like Hitler backing away from Satan.
This is my problem, is when you promote a film like this, you've got to do interviews with journalists, okay? And you have to do hundreds of interviews with journalists, and they're repetitive questions. And you could spend 2 days in front of magazines, TV shows, radio shows, promoting this film. And all one journalist has to say is, what did you do to learn about autism? And they'll go, well, nothing. Why should we? Nothing about autism. When actors portray people in real life, that you're normally going to spend days or weeks with people. I've had someone who's playing me in a film, and they've come here for a few days to learn how to use a wheelchair because I was disabled later on in life. Obviously, they were fully mobile and then become disabled, so they needed to learn how to use a wheelchair. And they spent a few days with me learning that aspect. So when Sia turns around and goes, well, what did you do about autism? I went, nothing. That's not helpful to anyone, is it?
No, I think the issue with Sia is that she went for a triple threat. And this was financial. This was strictly financial. The fact that she was in a good light, she's made a film about the autistic community or an autistic person. She had an album, and then she had every consequential single after that. So she would have had such a bankroll of money while feeling good about herself, and it's all fallen apart. And I genuinely believe there was no love letter. It was strictly financial, and she would have raked it in from this movie had it done well.
Here's the thing, it could have done well, and it could have been really good had she done her due diligence. And I know that I've had Sia fans tell me she'd done 3 years of research. How do you do that much research and get it so very, very wrong? Like, not a bit wrong, not kind of, oh, actually, it isn't special abilities, you can stay disabled. But the use of prone restraint, it being referred to as crushing her with love, the dance routines are so big, colourful and stroby that a lot of people on the autistic spectrum actually won't be able to watch them. The only black character in the film is Ghanaian and has HIV. Could you have hit that trope any harder if you tried to?
Is that true?
Yeah, Leslie Odom Jr.'s character has HIV.
Wow, and he's been nominated for 2 Golden Globes.
Oh, that's...
What sucks is that she's getting all this attention for it. There's a film which I got to see just recently after we spoke to one of the people involved, Nick Skur, called One Little Finger. Now, it's really low budget. It was made clearly on a low budget. I can't work with one autistic person because they found it too anxious. This is a film that's got 80 disabled actors and musicians involved with it. And they put the able-bodied actors to shame in the film, I've got to say. When you watch it, it's like they're acting a lot better than the able-bodied actors right now. It's not the best film in the world, but it's really interesting. But what I found particularly interesting is that in this same era that we've got this film coming out, and I can't work with one autistic person in an autistic role, this film comes out with 80. It's on Amazon Prime. 80 disabled actors and musicians who all came together and did it and did a really good job. Now, that just throws that out of the water. And the understanding of autism is so limited because if you know anything about autism, there's a great saying, you hear it a lot in autism circles, which is if you know one person with autism, you know one person with autism, because no two are the same. And if someone's finding it stressful, go and find the person who's not, because they're out there.
As I said before, laziness and ignorance.
Absolutely.
One of the arguments that I've heard a lot on Twitter from the Sia stands, but also from just people who don't really understand the debate that we're trying to have. If you cast an autistic person as an autistic character, it isn't acting. Should only dinosaurs play dinosaurs? Should only fairies play fairies? So on and so forth. And I replied to someone saying, so when BAME actors play BAME characters or female actors play female characters, is that not acting either? Where's the line here? And by the way, dinosaurs are extinct and fairies aren't real. Sorry to crush your dreams. And no one has like an intelligent response.
Tim Allen's career would have been screwed.
Well, as a handyman.
As a handyman, as a comedian. Santa Claus, apparently. Yeah.
So there are lines to this. And I think you draw the lines at protected characteristics. So should only rapists play rapists? No, rapists belong buried under the prison they're sent to and nowhere near the film industry. should a real bear play Paddington Bear? Absolutely. You can train it. Rock and roll. And it just shows the lack of understanding of what the actual conversation is and how far behind disability representation is systemically throughout the entire film industry. And we've got to stop equating disability with inability.
What was it like for you, Adam, when you were working on your film with Scarlett Johansson? How was that experience for you on the from the inside?
Well, it was good. The director was adamant he wanted to use an actual actor with a disfigurement. I didn't want to use prosthetics or take any shortcuts or do anything that was cheap. And I was listened to. I was treated like an equal. I was paid like an equal. And very much listened to and valued, which just shows when you listen to the voices of the communities you're trying to serve, it works. Only good things can happen. And it's a win-win. And just taking it back to Sia, oh, it's about my autistic friend. And it's true, she does have a non-verbal autistic friend who this movie's based on. His name's Stevie, and he's a black man. So why Maddie Ziegler is playing him, I have no idea. Whitewashing much. We can add that to the list of massive problems with this film.
Coming back to Adam with Scarlett Johansson, I just want to point out, Adam got paid lots and lots of money to be in a scene with Scarlett Johansson, who was naked, and now is on Pornhub with her.
Or let's flip that round. Scarlett Johansson got paid a lot of money to be naked with me and is now on Pornhub with me. The lesson there, Simon, is you give a little, you get a little. That's the takeaway. But even the other film I did, Chained for Life, which had a predominantly disabled cast, and it's sort of like a meta, almost satirical comedy on the history of disability in cinema, that's at 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, compared to Sears, I think it's at 12 now.
Yeah, that says it all.
Dropping. Yeah, it's going to disappear without a trace, hopefully.
Let's hope. The last thing I want is to be in 10 years' time having to explain to people that my daughter's not music. You know, how many people have to explain that they're not Rain Man now? Let's not make this another trope to carry forward for the next 10 years, 20 years, because the only single reference that we've got for autism in popular culture is Rain Man and music. I mean, jeez.
That's the thing, and this is my final point on this, I promise. This isn't a new conversation. The other argument that drives me insane is, well, no one said anything about The Good Doctor or Gilbert Grape or Atypical or Rain Man or Glee. And it's just, yeah, we did. And no one was bloody listening then either. So, by closing, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to give it 1 star. There'll be Sia fans listening to this at @Adam_Pearson. Come at me. I don't care anymore. So that's our spontaneous film review put to one side for now. Coming to you, Simon. Now, social media, we all have our bios and what have you. We're given the freedom to express our own characters how we choose to. And in the world of correct terminology, where does disability fit into all of this?
So this is a little thing that really annoys me on Twitter, on Facebook. And it's only a little thing, but I think it has wider implications. And I'm guilty of doing it myself. So when I introduced myself on this podcast earlier, I introduced myself as a disabled journalist. Well, I'm not really. I should be a journalist first, and then because I'm disabled, is I cover stories on disability. I know, that's why I run Ability Access. And when you've got 80,000 plus followers on social media and they start following you and they say your name, which is fine, and then they put spinal damage level 3, 4, and 5, which I don't get. It's not like Adam Pearson goes onto Twitter and goes, Adam Pearson, facial disfiguration. Or I go on there and go, spinal damage, corticoquina syndrome, Simon Sansom. And I think it's got to the point where people have to identify themselves as having a disability rather than just talking about disability or being a disability campaigner. And I think it's a slippery slope where people are losing their own identities to their disability. First point of call for me is I'm a person. Okay. Second thing is I'm a husband. And the third is, yes, I have a disability. But that's way down there. My family come first and everything. The disability is a part of me, yes, But that's probably the last thing on the list. It does cause issues when you go out and about and it affects your daily life, but everything else comes first before that. It's just that people are very quick to say, I have a disability. And one of the issues that happened to me a little while ago is I was in Costco, going around in my mobility scooter, as you do, and you get free samples. You know, this bloke handing out chicken on sticks. And he comes up to me and he goes, why are you in that thing? Well, first, my reaction in my head was, why the effing should I tell you what's wrong with me? You're handing out pieces of chicken. And then I thought, no, let's be smarter than that. And I said to him, can I have your email address, please? And he goes, excuse me? And he's really confused by that response. And I go, yeah, can I have your email address? He goes, what do you want that for? He goes, so I can send you my medical records. Because then he would find out exactly what's wrong with me. Now, you don't come up to someone and go, what's wrong with you? Why are you in that thing? It, you know, I would say, why are your eyes blue? Who did your mother shag to get blue eyes? It's that kind of question. And being identified on social media as being autism, being in a wheelchair, having a disability, I think should be secondary to everything else. Yes, you can campaign, of course, and it is down to personal choice as well, but I do think it's a slippery road where people are identifying by their disability rather than who they are.
I'm going to play devil's advocate a bit here. From the experience I've had of the actually autistic people I know, and I'm neurotypical, but I know a lot of autistic people, and there's this big sort of debate that ran. And the problem is that the medical professionals are actually instructed you use identity first terminology, whereas the generally, and this is generally, the actual autistic community prefer condition first, if you like. So they will say, I am autistic, not I have autism. And the reason is that they identify their autism as being such an integral part of them that they want to hold that up as this is a defining thing. So for people who are putting it on social media and saying, I am disabled in this way, I wonder if it's that same way of embracing something and saying, no, this is who I am. You can take me as that. Maybe it's because it's more of a hidden disability. Mm-hmm. But I do think there's something of that pride. And you see it cross over into, you know, sexuality and stuff like that. A lot of people put in their Twitter their orientation, how you should refer to them, she, her, he, him, them, they, often gets put on there as well. And it's because it's something that's so integral to them that they're taking as, this is me and I'm going to be proud of it. And I wonder if that wraps into it somehow.
I think it absolutely does. I think it all comes down to identity and how you, and if someone chooses to identify themselves in that way, more power to them, in my opinion. Mm. It's when you get put in that box by other people under duress almost that it then becomes a problem. Yes. So it becomes pejorative and problematic that I start to develop problems with it. And much like you, I'm neurotypical, but I'm ND adjacent. And I completely understand that people wear it as sort of like a badge of almost honor and in embracing who they are by saying it out loud, or almost like the opposite of Lord Voldemort. I say this out loud because I'm not afraid of it, and I'm proud of it.
There is a support network there also. Is when they put actually autistic, there's a hashtag, so they can support each other, so they can identify who else is and what they're going through. Same as the SEND Twitter community. Now, they can put it out there, and they do have it in their bios as well. But it's kind of apples and oranges, though, isn't it? Because it is hidden disability, a disability that you can see.
It is. And I think, you know, going back to what Simon's talking about in his Costco, I mean, that's just the most arrogant question a person can ask.
Yeah.
I did put in a written complaint about that, and I got a very nice reply. And they said that it was done by that Costco didn't take responsibility for it because the people who hand out the chicken samples and all of the other samples are contracted by another company. And Costco said, we're not having you back unless you put your staff under human rights disability training or something along those lines.
Oh, wow.
At least they're taking it seriously.
Yeah. So it's not like, you know, I wasn't being insulting. I put in a genuine complaint because, you know, I wouldn't want someone come up to me and go, you know, why are you black? Why are you white? Why are you Asian? Why are you disabled? You know, it's the most absurd question in the world.
I was going to have on my Twitter, utter prick. But I was worried about connecting with utter pricks all across the world in that same way that Chris was talking about. So I've retracted that one now. But
yeah. That's the thing. They did address it. And that's what I was grateful for. It raised awareness. They took it seriously. And when I went back, the bloke, because it was the same bloke a few weeks later who was handing out sausage samples this time.
We're not trusting him with chicken anymore. It's a salmonella outbreak everywhere.
Gone from chicken to pigs.
Have you seen Animal Farm?
Been demoted. He just said, hello, how you doing? Nice to see you again. And I thought, that's really, that's how you should be addressed. Yeah, not kicking your tires on your scooter saying, you know, why are you in this thing? It was nice that he'd been on a training course. It wasn't that he did it wrong. It's just that he didn't know how to address it.
Yeah.
And that's the issue.
And I feel bad about that. I think that goes on a lot. I think Chris and I have spoken in the past, and we talk about this a lot, that there needs to be education in schools on what disability is at an early age. Because if we want to remove the stigma that's attached with any form of disability, simply educating people about it at that early age removes the confusion and the awkwardness. And I think it's that people are faced with it and, oh, what do I say? And I've done it myself in other situations. There are situations I've been in where people have represented themselves in one way or another, and I'm suddenly confronted of how do I address this? I had a friend who was transsexual, who I'd known beforehand and bumped into at McDonald's, and it took me about 10 minutes to work out. I was like, I'm sure I know her from somewhere. And then it dawned on me, and suddenly I was lost for words. How do I suddenly address this person? Because she walked by afterwards and was sort of staring at me as if, you recognize me, don't you? Why haven't you said hi? And I was just so bad, because I could have dealt with that situation so much better. But it was like a deer in the headlights. And I'd love to see that just get out there, that if people are educated, just how do you respond to something? And it shouldn't actually be an issue. People, we talk about diversity all the time, and how diversity is this wonderful thing. We live in a diverse world of so many different races, colors, genders, sexualities, you know, hairstyles, fat, thin, small, short, whatever you are, old. It's just who we are. And it shouldn't be questioned like that. It shouldn't.
Do you think political correctness has become a bit of a double-edged sword, where people are now so afraid of inadvertently saying the wrong thing that we just all now sit in awkward silence and are just too afraid to have the conversation for fear of offending someone or being cancelled? And how do we break down that barrier and give people, I suppose, the freedom and the confidence to ask awkward questions? Or we joked earlier about stupid questions. I'd rather someone ask me a really stupid, offensive question about my disability, but do it sincerely, and then have that conversation where we both leave better people, than just jump down their throat and be like, how dare you say that to me? Oh, why don't you make a movie about your bigotry? You know, that kind of thing. Give people the freedom to get it wrong so you can lovingly correct them into the correct mindset, or you can sort of address their anxieties before it becomes a prejudice, if that makes sense.
There is an issue where people are terrified of saying the wrong thing, and they're scared of losing their jobs, offending someone, and they shouldn't be. You should have an open, honest conversation about it. And the only place at the moment where open, honest conversations are happening are either in Parliament, on Zoom during council meetings, parish council meetings, or on question time. You know, other than that, things are not being discussed in day-to-day living. And I think it does come down to the point of education, where it needs to be an everyday discussion, starting at a younger age. So when you do get older, you're fully aware of the situation that you're going to run into eventually.
I completely agree. And I think people are scared. And the problem is, I see this on Twitter a lot. If somebody speaks out of turn, or simply out of, I come across this on my Facebook group. You've got new parents who come in. All they've had is the education from doctors. So they're told to say, your child has autism. Not that your child is autistic. They're told about different levels of autism, even though that's being discarded now. Professionals are still using it. So these parents come in asking questions, and then get jumped on by people because then they haven't understood yet. They haven't had the time to learn that there are certain ways to refer to things. And I think this is part of the problem is that there's so many people ready to jump on an attack when something wrong is said, rather than having what Adam's talking about, which is having that rational conversation that says, no, I just want to explain to you. I did this myself. I was interviewing my cousin, actually, whose son has Down syndrome. And I referred to him as Downs. And she very nicely corrected me and said, actually, we say they have Down syndrome. We use identity first, not disability first. And it was nice because I learned. I know now to do that, and I won't refer to it incorrectly again. But it's because I had a decent conversation. There's so much more to be gained when people have these rational discussions and are actually able to be educated rather than attacked, which immediately gets the defences up and it gets nowhere.
I do think it's social media, though. Like you said, you knew your cousin and she corrected you. And I think if you got individuals on their own, they would correct you also. But it's the fact that it's a show now. It's everybody's eyes are on you, and that gives them a buzz. They want to jump on with everything they've got, and they want everybody else with a mob mentality to all jump on. And it's a mixture of boredom, wanting excitement, and the same people will be throwing out the same hashtag of be kind. Also with social media, some people weaponize it. So they will act ignorant to it when they know they're being offensive. And that's where you get your trolls.
That's the bigger issue as well. You get people who take almost pleasure in using these terms and it becomes offensive.
And they've tribalized as well. They've become big groups that like to do this. They know each other and they will jump onto other groups and there'll be this big tussle and everybody's excited and angry and everybody's chasing an emotion that they haven't got in real life.
Where do you draw the line between legitimate criticism of something like CS film and a almost mobbish mentality? If someone puts the wrong thing, for example, in a facial disfigurement Facebook group or a neurofibromatosis 1, which is my condition's Facebook group, and I instantly jump down their throat, all that person is going to come away from is thinking I'm a bit of a prick, and at least get to know me before you figure that one out. But also, I've got to really watch what I do because other people will follow. And so it's a case of, I suppose, policing tone, policing intent. And there are so many variables that go into these deep conversations that are just woefully absent or unconsidered in social media. You write it, you tweet it, and you think about it later.
See, this is a really good point, and I think you made the point earlier that you've seen Sears film. So your perspective is from an education perspective because you've seen it. You can reference it. You can talk about it because I can't talk about it yet because I haven't seen it, and which is why I made the point. I want to be able to see it, and I want to try and find something positive in it. So I don't want to go in with a negative mindset already in there looking for all the problems because that's going to be my natural way to go in. I need to go in with that mindset. And I think we need to address that in ourselves. If we, before joining a mob, why are we doing it? Is it actually because we feel passionately about this, or is it because we've read 6,000 tweets about it?
And they want to join in.
That's it.
People follow the flow. They don't have their own opinions.
Well, Adam made the very good point, though. He used a word while you were speaking, which is intent. Now, if Sia had backed away and said, I apologize, I didn't do this, I didn't do that, I am sorry that I've hurt, or and physically made steps to try and address and improve the relationship with the autistic community, I think all of this would have blown over. I think
Anne Hathaway is the perfect example. Anne Hathaway, when she did Witches, came under the same sort of criticism because it was obviously demonizing people who had
limb disorders. The actual condition is electrodactyly.
And Anne Hathaway, this all sort of exploded on social media. Anne Hathaway didn't respond to some people's annoyance at first. What she did was process it for a couple of days, then came on with a thought through, articulate response that was, I'm so sorry. It hadn't even occurred to me making this that this could be perceived this way. I'm really sorry. And please accept my apology.
And people accepted that.
Yeah, because it was heartfelt. It was genuine. It wasn't. Was. Exactly. And it was accepting responsibility. It wasn't trying to deflect it. It was like, I screwed up and I'm really sorry.
So moving on, I nearly swore in that last segment, and to that I thought, oops, I did it again. Segue! The new Britney Spears documentary has come out, and by all accounts, it's bloody brilliant. Duncan, Britney Spears, hit me, baby. One more time.
One more time. I want to start off by saying I'm not a Britney Spears fan at all.
No.
No, I know. It's a shock to a lot of people that I'm not a particularly big Britney Spears fan, but I actually respect what she's achieved. And I read a very interesting article in The Times just the other day that was talking about this new documentary that's coming out, which is now out. You can get it on Sky and everything. You can download it. All about this Free Britney Spears movement that's going on, I think called Free Britney Spears, about the fact that her father's really in control of all of her money because of what she went through with her mental health. And what it really opened up in this article for me was this, and it's something I've considered for a long time, is whether fame, when you're too young, is actually a form of abuse in itself. Because I can only think of a handful of child stars that have come through the other side of fame with their sanity and their integrity intact, really. You think of people like, you know, Macaulay Culkin's only just come out the other side now, all these years later. He went through, a living hell. You've got Elijah Wood, who was the opposite of that. He's somebody who weathered it really well. I think the guys from the Harry Potter films have all come out. I think something in the way those films were made and the care that was taken of the kids at the time was really good. Mm-hmm. It just seems, I worry about YouTubers now and all these kids who are becoming megastars. And I don't think you're able to process that fame and keep yourself grounded at that age. It's too early.
Well, I mean, from a person who's seen Britney Spears live, I should say one thing about Britney Spears. If you get the chance to see Britney Spears live, do not see Britney Spears live. No, I agree with you. What she's achieved is mega success, and she will always be remembered as having huge amounts of hits and a megastar who has a fortune of $500 million or something stupid. But from what I understand, she was pushed into that industry when she was 8, 9, 10, 11 years old. Then she went on to Disney with people like Justin Timberlake, and her family wanted her to be famous. She wanted to be famous. Every generation, there is someone who comes along who is pushed into that situation. For example, Michael Jackson, who do not come off it well at all because of the fame, the success, and they cannot handle the situation. You're getting fan mails, you're getting things in the post, you can't go out, you've got security around you 24 hours a day, you can't have a moment's peace. And what I've noticed is if you actually listen to Britney Spears' songs, they are incredibly sad. They are her trying to escape from what I believe is her abusive situation. I'm not a girl, not yet a woman. I want to make you happy. You know, I was born to make you happy. The songs are really sad and really personal. And people see them as uplifting, and they're not. They are depressive songs, but they're shown in a way that are fun, that are entertaining, and they're catchy. But when you actually listen to the tone of the songs and when you actually listen to the lyrics of the songs, you're thinking, this is actually quite dark. And I think that was shown later on in her life, in her career, that the writers of those songs were reflecting what was happening to her.
That makes perfect sense. Circus, Give Me More, how much even, can she even, take of this? That is spot on.
Even Lucky, kind of, she's so lucky, she's a star.
Yeah, absolutely.
But she cries. Yeah.
I mean, one of them is about her committing suicide in the bathtub.
What I've seen in the documentary so far, her father's actually been quoted as saying, she's going to buy me a boat one day. So the intent there is purely that, we want to market her to make as much money as we possibly can. And that was what it was all about. And it's sad. She was so young. And I think I actually respect, because I think mental health is a disability that gets talked about a lot, but not recognized really as being a disability as much. And I think it's something that when you're in the throes of low mental health or poor mental health, it is as crippling as any other disability, because it's overwhelming. It completely takes over your life. I live with this in my life, not personally, but I have people close to me who suffer with lifelong depressive conditions, and it's crippling. And you see what this does to people. And for her, this was forced upon her. And I honestly feel like her brain couldn't take what was being thrown at her. And that's why she went through this period of crumbling. But what she did was be able to pick herself back up. She's got herself well again. And she's actually been very free with talking about it, which I really respect. She's taking that stigma away. And, you know, the more people who can do that, the better, in my opinion. But it really makes me sad that she was being thrust into this situation. I think Michael Jackson's a really apt comparison as well, because, again, he was thrown into that. He was, you know, pushed into fame at a very young age by his father.
I remember watching a Michael Jackson documentary years ago, and I can't remember who said it. I think it was one of the brothers, where Michael Jackson was, you know, 10 years old, and his brothers obviously were like 10 years older than him, and they all had girls in the room, and doing stuff with girls in the room when he was sitting in the corner reading, playing with his comic books. Yeah. I mean, if that doesn't do anything to you, I don't know what does.
The similar thing happened to Dustin Diamond when he was in the original Saved by the Bell.
Yes.
He was at the Playboy Mansion as like a really young child. And being exposed to that much, I suppose, debauchery at such a young age can not be healthy. And to come back to something Duncan said earlier, I think particularly when we hear celebrities talking about mental health, we can often be quite dismissive and be like, mate, what do you have to be depressed about? You're a flipping millionaire. You have it all. And it's like, well, they don't have it all. They have these really superficial relationships with millions of people online. But everyone's just hanging around with them because they're making them money, or there's a lot of people who are kind of withdrawing from the Bank of Brittany, but not enough people depositing into the Bank of Brittany. Absolutely. To offset all those withdrawals. Yes. Where she's given out so much but been given so little, and that forces people into like these really dark and lonely, isolating places and dangerous thought patterns, where there are those moments where she's probably thought, if I stop doing this, will anyone still love me?
And I think the other side of that, and it's swinging about around to what we were talking about before a lot as well, is social media is so aggressive. I was talking to Yazzie last week, who's an up-and-coming singer-songwriter. She's young, she's very talented. And the question that we asked her was, how do you handle the social media feedback? Because it's obviously it can be so aggressive. And she was very wise with it. I mean, I know, I want to hear it again, your method of dealing with social media, Adam, when you've got trolls.
Well, sometimes you correct the grammar and you move on, or you kind of correct their facts. And you take it always like a case-by-case thing, because sometimes you just don't want to engage at all. And trolls are rarely the intellectual bastions of their friendship circles. And you give it the credence it deserves, which is normally none.
What I really loved was that you don't retweet, you screenshot and then do the correction. So I don't get the credit for it. It's genius.
Then they get the attention that they want, don't they? That's what they want you to do. I also follow them, but then block them before they can follow me back.
I do think we are talking about two different levels of fame here as well regarding social media and Britney Spears fame. And the reason for it is for example, I've got 80 odd plus thousand followers on social media. Adam's got quite a lot. I don't have anyone sitting outside my house 24 hours a day, other paparazzi outside my front door.
Where yeah, you Britney do. I'm is... waving right now, Simon. Can you see me waving from 100 meters away? My boss patted you on the head last week. He says you were rude.
Britney Spears' fame has been there for such a long time where people, paparazzi, camp outside her house. They follow her everywhere they go. She's got stalkers who follow her and her kids everywhere they go. Wherever she goes on holiday, they are taking pictures of her. Wherever their family goes, they are taking pictures of her in case she turns up there. And news organizations or paparazzi get paid to get, you know, a large sum of money if they snap her buying something from Gucci. If you've got 10 million followers on social media, you do not have that attention. You have the option to delete it, and they are not standing outside your house.
I'll flip that back, because you've got people like Ryan's World. You've got this little kid, Ryan, who's being thrust through all this. Now, he's just on YouTube, but it's out on the social media sphere. And I mean, he's getting TV stuff now. He's on Nickelodeon and stuff like that. But again, it's like this, they're growing, they're forced to grow up in public. And I think that's part of the problem. We make our mistakes in private growing up. We may make a stupid tweet. We can delete it. We may say something stupid. It's only a select few people who are there to hear it. But more and more, these people are being thrust into having to force to grow up publicly. And like you say, you get these people, paparazzi badgering them all the time and stuff like that. Fans who come up to you on the street. And social media is actually bringing its own celebrities who are getting, like, literally hundreds of millions of followers, tens of millions at least, people who are checking out their every single thing. Like I say, especially for the kids, they're forced to grow up in public.
But then I think, again, to play devil's advocate, just because you're young and you're YouTube famous, that doesn't, and of course you're going to make mistakes in a very public arena, doesn't devoid you from accountability. When Logan Paul went to that Japanese suicide forest and people called him out, and he was like, oh, I'm just a kid. I was like, you're a 21-year-old man that did something wildly stupid. Yeah. And we're a prick about it. That this isn't a bullying, this isn't lynch mobbing. You were a prick, and now people are calling you out for being a prick. You lost your YouTube deal, you lost your Disney deal. Yeah. And by the same token, actions have consequences.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Logan Paul, 21, is old enough to make these decisions and help be accountable. Britney was 10 when she was thrust into this. And like I say, kids like Ryan, they're pre that age when they're thrust into fame, they're growing up in this spotlight that is just so intense. And those are the years, like it's that sort of, you're hitting puberty, you're going through changes, and it's suddenly very public.
It's the support network that they've got growing up, though, isn't it? You look at, for instance, Logan Paul, because I know a little bit about Jake Paul and Logan Paul and their history and their parents, and I can see why they are like they are. I can also see why Britney is the way she is, same with Justin Timberlake. It depends on who you've got around you and who keeps you grounded, who can tell you what's right and wrong while you're going through this. Now, it's not going to be for definite that you're going to get through this unscathed, but it certainly plays a huge part if you've got that kind hand on your shoulder telling you that things are going to be okay, this is how you do things, this is how the world is, rather than someone that's treating you like a cash cow.
The Harry Potter kids, they've all grown into really likable and, like you say, grounded adults and have done some amazing things as a result post the Harry Potter fame. And I do think that's because that they were growing up around seasoned actors as well, who were aware of the dangers and keeping them very safe and secure in that. And I do think that makes a big difference.
I remember a story where Daniel Radcliffe got his first proper paycheck. It was like for his third film because he was old enough to have it. And he got 17.5 million. Don't quote me on this, but I think it was Alan Rickman who took him out to buy his first car. And with that kind of money, you can have a Ferrari, you can have Maserati, you can have whatever you like. Okay. He went out and bought a Ford Mondeo.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think that goes to show that, yes, those kids were looked after. Yes, they were grounded. They were kept down to earth and say, yes, you've got all this money, but you've also got to be careful with what's going to happen in life, because people are going to stalk you for the rest of your life because you are Harry Potter and they are going to follow you forever. But you also got, you know, look after yourself and be sensible about for the rest of your life.
Completely. The worst thing that you can do, to my mind, if you're young and famous, is surround yourself with glad-handed yes men who will just tell you what you want to hear. Mm. You need someone that loves you enough to sit you down. And I, with my very limited, minuscule fame compared to the people we're talking about, have got a group of people around me, one of whom might be on this call, that will just sit me down and be like, you've been a prick, read it in.
Yeah, that's going to be me, isn't it, Adam?
I can neither confirm nor deny that for legal reasons. Yeah, I've got the screenshots.
We'll say, Simon, you're doing a terrible job.
Yeah, I always put Adam in his place. I'm not going to lie.
But he buys me cake while he's doing it. So sometimes I do it on purpose.
You sound just like my daughter.
And then I have very long conversations with your wife about what Lego to get you.
Yeah. Half of that sentence came along. It was starting.
Yeah, to... I was wondering the same thing.
You just left that hanging. I have conversations with your wife.
Yeah.
On now to our final topic, and ever the man of mystery, Chris, you decided you're only going to tell us the headline and let us fill in the gaps in between.
Woman fined after walking husband on a lead, telling police he was a dog.
Look, I was young, I needed the money.
In Canada, fined £900 because it was due to the curfew where they can't go out together. So she tried to get away with it by saying he's a dog.
I mean, Canadians are known for being polite. Was she just trying to be polite to her husband?
That's a clean way of looking at it. I was thinking more along the lines of something else, to be honest.
There's certain overtones to this that really do scream to some level. I'm actually wondering if someone was to go up and pat him on the head and say, oh, it's good to see you out. Is that as offensive now? <he's a dog?"
laughs> That's what I'd have done. In that moment, I would have probably pretended I was blind and been like, oh, bollocks, I've left the dog at home. Duncan, why didn't you say something?
I was thinking more of the lines of Granny Dominatrix.
That's what was in my head. That's, I think it's because, has anybody ever watched Preacher?
Oh, I have. It's amazing.
You have?
I showed it to my mom. I showed Preacher to my 71-year-old mother, and she loved it. So it's that backfired. Great.
God in it wears a latex dog suit in it, and that is what immediately popped into my head.
I remember that looking for the first lamppost.
He cocked his leg to try and get away with it.
You just hope she doesn't have a doggy bag to pick the poo up afterwards.
Oh, God.
How bad would it have been at the end of the war, though?
All I'm thinking is, how dull must Canada be if this made the news? Like, on Croydon, that's a Wednesday. So, like, man on a leash and 10 wings to 3 quid at the Dragon, Wednesdays, rock and roll.
I'm just wondering, I never knew Canada had a Soho area.
I'm wondering where this took place as well. Was it outside the Gothic Castle? One for the Arrested Development fans there.
Oh, I bet you it was done outside the Canadian version of the Moulin Rouge.
Well, wasn't that specific, but I think probably spot on with that.
How do you know there's a Canadian version of the Moulin Rouge, Simon?
I'm Canadian, actually.
Ah, okay. We are learning a lot today, aren't we? Nice. Simon Sampson, disabled Canadian journalist, likes of Russell. Good to know. And that, unfortunately, brings us to the end of our show, gentlemen. It's been a pleasure hanging out with you. And to everyone watching, we'd like to thank you. We'd like you all to drop a like, drop a comment, drop a subscribe, and get involved. If there's something you want us to talk about, feel free to get in touch. And if we deem it worthy of our time, we will put it in the show. But all that's left to say is it's goodbye from me, it's goodbye from my fellow Grumpy Gits, and we will see you on the next one.